So there I was, staring at the scene of the crime, but it wasn't like any crime I had ever seen. Just as I was wondering who could be responsible for this episode, the answer walked in a pair of stilettos and not much more. She had legs for miles and a smile that asked you to take a ride with her. I wanted to see what she was driving at. "Whose podcast is this?" I asked, jerking my thumb at the iTunes feed. "You're listening to The Deceptionists," she said, and she wasn't lying. She told me about Dave and Caroline and Jim, and how they were talking to special guest Jay Stringer. I knew she was stringing me along, but I didn't really care. "Ain't a crime to talk," I said. "If all you do is talk," she replied, leaning close. I was so hypnotized by the shine on her lips, I almost missed the gleam of the knife. Welcome to The Deceptionists, Truth Through Fiction. Now, this is normally where we tell you that we're a fortnightly or so podcast about the craft of writing fiction, but if you've been following along, we've really kind of extended that or so quite a bit. So I want to address that really quickly before we get started. We have taken an unintended hiatus. It's one of those things where we all got a little busy, and a lot happened in our personal lives, and some of that I'll share on my side. I have some pretty good news that I'll share in the what we're working on section, but it was never our intention to leave you all hanging. We want to pick up the shows where we left off, and it just is an unfortunate case of everyone trying to come together. We almost recorded at one point, and you know, we're actually recording across four different time zones this time. We'll get to that in a minute when we talk to our special guest for tonight. But we are back, and we have some shows planned. We're going to resume our fortnightly, hopefully less on the or so schedule from here on out, but we do have some more shows for you, and I want to thank everyone who has been listening and who has been very vocal in missing us. It's been very nice to see that on Twitter and the like. So I am, of course, Dave Ocampo, and joining me tonight for our returning show is Caroline Pruitt.
Hello.
And Jim Rochkowski.
Hi there.
And tonight we are talking about crime. If you know, for all we know, you're listening to this in the year 2013 and you're looking in the archives of the, you know, global deceptionist empire. And so you don't even know that we missed a couple months there. But but if you have been following along, we were doing genre shows. We were tackling what it's like to write in different genres, struggles that we have with them, how we define them, really just what we think about it from a writer's point of view. And so to that end, we've had a few different special guests, and very excited tonight to have our special guest tonight is Mr. Jay Stringer.
Hello.
Jay is coming to us from across the pond. Scotland, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, Glasgow.
Yes. So Jay is a crime writer, a blogger on the and podcaster. If you're not familiar with Do Some Damage, do yourself a favor and check that out. It's a, I guess they call it an intense look or an inside look at writing crime fiction, right? You guys are, the podcast, actually Paul Montgomery of our own Deceptionists guested on one of Jay's shows, and they talked about crime comics, and that was a really good podcast.
And that was an epic podcast.
Epic podcast. Jay also joined Paul for some of the Doctor Who recaps on the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast. But, you know, the Do Some Damage podcast is excellent in its own right, and you know, we couldn't think of anybody better that we'd like to have talking about crime with us. So welcome, Jay.
I'm very happy to be here.
So in the past shows, we've really started off by defining the genre that we're talking about in terms of, we understand that there are a lot of exceptions to the rules as we lay them out, but the idea of genres, of as we've talked about them, is there are certain guidelines, or there are certain rules that can be applied, and sometimes these are marketing terms. Sometimes they are, right, you know, guideposts in writing fiction. And, you know, as we talked about different things, we've talked about horror, we've talked about romance, we've talked about science fiction and how those are all defined. So let's talk about crime. Let me turn it over to Caroline. Let me turn it over to you. I know you have a big fascination with crime novels, crime fiction. So what do you think of when you think of crime?
it's interesting because when we were setting out these genre shows and we were giving out prompts and the different genres, I think I mentioned this last time, a friend of mine was trying to do the crime prompt, and she was actually confused about what that category was because she's like, can I have, like, cops in it, or can it, does it just have to be about criminals? And I realized, I'm like, I think it's actually, we usually use crime to talk about this larger category, which can include the traditional detective or mystery story. It also kind of includes the noir story at the other end, or the heist story where you're in the point of view of the criminal. So I think as long as you kind of have usually one major crime or type of crime at the center of the story, then I think the different types of variations on the genre, a lot of it comes from the viewpoint, whether you're looking at it as a story of somebody who's solving a crime, whether you're looking at it as a victim story, whether you're looking at it as a story of someone committing a crime. And I think that's really where the spectrum comes from.
And the crime is not typically shoplifting. It should be said, like, there's usually, if not often, a certain amount of violence. You know, maybe a valuable MacGuffin has gone missing, something like that. You know, we talk about crimes, but there, I think even which crimes are committed in a crime story are somewhat more limited.
Yeah, I think like the traditional golden age mystery story that was a murder in the first couple chapters, and then you spent the time solving the murder. And right. Then you'd also, I guess, the heist story is another tradition where you're trying to pull off a big robbery, but there's still are usually some bodies before the end of it. And I think maybe we've expanded a little bit to look at stuff like drug trafficking and things like that. But again, that's mm-hmm. not shoplifting, you know, but it doesn't right. necessarily have to be a violent crime to start with, but you're probably eventually going to have some violence.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we talk about crime, so what we're saying here is that this genre is really defined by there being this serious crime, you know, not crimes of bad taste in movies or, you know, I get your point on that one, Jim, for sure.
Right.
But, and I'm rewriting my detective novel about trying to uncover a guy right. who's, whose crime is
mattress tag destruction. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, but that's really interesting to me because why is that so fascinating to us? Why is that a genre in itself? Because, I mean, we can have a fantasy story that revolves around, I don't know, a king being murdered, you know, but it ends up being trumped out of a crime story by being some epic fantasy tale, right? You know, good and evil fighting and battling. But crime, for there to be a crime at the center of it, for that to have sort of formed its own genre around it. I think, Jay, I think you had some interesting thoughts that you mentioned to us previously about crime as social fiction. Do you want to share mm-hmm. with us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, and as you said at the top, that this isn't a hard and fast, you know, different people are going to have different takes. But for me, good crime fiction is social fiction. It's, you know, it's looking at the haves and the have-nots, and you know who wants something, who's got something, who's deprived, and that really fiction, like all the fiction, like The Grapes of Wrath and Charles Dickens, I think they're really crime novels if you use a modern definition. That you know the definitions have shifted over time, but they're really books about people who've not got something, or the you know the difference between the upper class and the lower class. And as long as you've got a story where you've basically got somebody who really wants something that they can't get and someone else has got it, then you're going to get a crime story.
And that's really fascinating because isn't that one of the most basic craft of fiction exercises that we sort of talk about in writing classes, like creative writing 101? It's, well, you know, you set up a character and they have a desire and then they have an obstacle. And so it strikes me that crime fiction in its way is sort of the purest essence of that. You know, you're just taking the stakes beyond, you know, oh, I really kind of want you know, his girl that he has, and I want her to be mine, you know, but it's taking it to beyond that to, you know, committing a crime to get her, you know, to get her, murdering the guy so we can get her, whatever it is. It's sort of taking it to its logical extreme in a sense. And I think maybe that's one of the things that's very compelling.
And I think this is probably where my high school film teacher would tell me that it is also, there's certainly an element of vicarious living or catharsis. Like we watch a movie like, well, I've never seen Scarface, but I presume someone would watch a movie like Scarface because we have rules. We're good little boys and girls. We stay within the lines, but we like to live through the characters and see them getting away with things that we would never attempt in the first place.
Yeah, you're definitely onto something there. I mean, it's kind of, I think it depends on which, you know, either which approach you take when you're writing it, whether you're going to write from the point of view of the person committing the crime or the violent act, or whether you're writing from the point of view of the person suffering from it. But there can be often be an element of kind of tourism to crime fiction.
Right.
And sometimes that can stray too far. Sometimes you can kind of look at people's reactions and think, oh, I'm not sure you're getting the right thing out of this.
Right.
But it's most basic that, yeah, there is a bit of an element of tourism to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think it depends which direction you're going with it. A lot of noir fiction, you've got the sort of guy who's in the wrong place at the wrong time, or maybe, you know, doors are shutting all around him, closing in on him, and it's just like he made one mistake, and he it's just compounding one thing after another. He witnessed something the wrong way, or he did something a little off, but you kind of root for him a little bit. In some cases, they can be despicable characters, but you know, in a sense, it might be sort of this guy uncovering corruption or something like that. On the flip side, there's the simple thrill of the detective, the vicarious thrill of the detective actually catching the killer. So it's not necessarily like, oh, it's, you know, crime fiction is always about, oh, I want to be that killer. Sometimes it can be, you know, oh, I want to catch that, or, you know, look how that thrill of the success of, you know, stopping a person from doing more harm or solving,
or even seeing, yeah, even seeing if you can figure it out before the book lays it out for you.
Yes. And that kind of gets into mystery versus crime, which, I'm sorry, Carol, before we do that, Caroline, did you have something you wanted to get in
there? Yeah, I wanted to just stick up for a minute for the traditional mystery side of the equation, because I think there's a little bit more glamour attached to the kind of the noir side, the dark side, I guess, of the criminal point of view, which you guys are talking about, which is definitely something that you enjoy reading. But I think there's a knock on the detective fiction side, the mystery side, the procedural side, of saying, oh, well, people who don't like these kind of books say that it's basically they're a cheat, because you basically are taking something that's messy and destructive and it all has to be wrapped up into a neat little bow at the end. That's sort of and I definitely think you see that, and you can see that in some of what's called the sort of the traditional cozy mystery, is the idea of, like, you know, you have the old lady in the village who solves crimes with the help of her cat and gets everything back. And for some of those books can actually be really fun, and I'm already sounding more dismissive than I mean to be. But I think it's too simple to say that because you have a detective and they solve the crime at the end, that this is somehow diminishing the importance of what's happened and diminishing the tragedy and diminishing the consequences, because I have seen that criticism made a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think good detective writing is always dealing with consequences, dealing with cleaning up these messes that have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, really getting into the psychology of what's going on. And that can be done in a lighter tone, and it can be done in... And I mean, one thing is that a lot of the detective novels are series novels. So basically, you'll have a book, you're introduced to a detective and their sort of supporting cast, and then every book builds on what's happened in the previous one. So you really have this idea, this cumulative effect, mm-hmm, on these characters. And when they're well done, the world that they encounter, whether it's sort of getting deeper into the same world that they've been a part of, or if it's the kind of series where in each book you use it to examine sort of different part of the society.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and to your point, I mean, while some people may knock it, I don't think, I'm certainly not doing that here, or not trying to, but I think there's a slightly different read to a lot of this stuff. But I think that mystery is probably largely more popular than noir, mm-hmm, in terms of published fiction. it seems to me that the beach read, you know, is often a mystery. We really like that. Or look at television. Television is littered with procedural kind of mysteries, you know, where, you know, the CSI type of thing, where it starts off with a body and then we have to go and interview the suspects and they close. And it's very, can be very formulaic. So maybe is that where some people knock it, because it can lapse so much into that formula that sometimes it seems like it's nothing but the formula?
Right. I think that that's the, yeah. And again, it's easy to, because it's popular and because a lot of it is coming out, it's easy to, for it to kind of get samey. But yeah. I think like with any genre, the trick is to make it new every time, to explore sure. something different with those same set of tools.
And there's something really fun about mystery. There's something, I mean, I don't... I've read some mystery novels. I tend to probably read more on the noir side, but like films, I love a good mystery film. I love something that, you know, kind of keeps you guessing and, you know, kind of lays out the clues for you and you kind of follow along. I think it's a slightly different kind of reading. You know, mm-hmm. it's can I figure it out faster than the detective? And in some cases, books are written to really give you everything so you can put it together. And I think in other cases, films or books are laid out in a way where you can't actually really. You have to wait for the you know, writer to tell you what's and put it all together for you.
It seems to me that a large number of the mysteries that I've encountered, whether they be movies or stories, have always they've always sort of relied on the killer being someone who you've never met before. You know, they seem to have stacked the deck.
The butler did it, kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Like, you know, there would have been no possible way for you to know those characters had any relationship whatsoever, or yeah. whatever else it might be. I don't know why. I guess if they didn't do it that way, they run the risk of being too easy to decipher.
Yeah.
I don't know where I saw this. This came up somewhere. I was at a con this past weekend, and this came up somewhere in reference to people talking about Scooby-Doo, which is sort of, I think, probably for a lot of us, that's our first exposure to the Scooby-Doo cartoon. And somebody said, they asked their kid, like, why do you like to keep watching this? It's all, you know, it's always a guy in a mask. And the kid says, but it's a, every time it's a different guy in a different mask.
I think when you were talking about consequences, that kind of, that's where it hits home for me, that the good mystery fiction is fantastic, and it's when it deals with consequences, and when the consequences carry over if it's a series, whereas the, you know, a weaker mystery might not deal so much with it might ignore consequences, the character might not grow or change as the series goes on. And that can, I think it's very easy to tar all mystery with the brush of a couple of bad examples, but some of the best writers in crime are mystery writers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think just talking briefly about, you know, constructing a mystery, and I think we'll talk more about writing later, but it just strikes me when we're talking about, when I think about a mystery, when I think about what a writer has to do for a mystery versus like a noir kind of fiction, is there's just a little different way you play it. I almost think of it as like turning, you know, a crime fiction piece inside out, because you have to kind of layer things over it, and, you know, you put an emphasis on the crime. Maybe the crime happens usually happens at the beginning, but everything that happened is what you're sort of hiding, and you're having someone dig in and reveal that slowly. So it's sort of a different way of constructing, but you still, if you're doing it well, you still have to deal with the same desires. Someone doesn't have something and they want it, you know, it's just that you're coming at it from a different direction, you know, and I think that's really interesting, and it kind of makes a little game of it, you know, with the reader in that sense. And so I think that maybe is one of the reasons that it's a very popular form, you know, but if done well, as you guys are saying, it deals with the desires and it deals with the consequences of those actions. I think sometimes it's easier maybe to write a crime piece, like a noir piece, where you're seeing the consequences, because those consequences directly, immediately, viscerally impact the next action of the character, you know, as they make one wrong move and then, oh, the cops are at the door. How are they going to get out of this? You know, and then something, oh, there's a back door that opens and there's a person there, but oh, maybe you shouldn't have gone with that person because, you know, that leads you down another path. And you know, really good crime fiction like that can be, this is maybe almost the thriller format, if we want to talk about that at all, too, you know, where you're sort of just wrenching up the tension for the reader by having, you know, throwing the protagonist, you know, out of the frying pan and into the fire, that kind of thing, over and over again.
By the way, if you look up crime fiction in Wikipedia, you would leave with the impression that it was just the works of Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, dear God. And that was about it.
There
must be crime wikis online or something. That's a shame.
Well, maybe it's up to us. We can seize the editorial reins and set them straight.
Let's change the world right now.
Right. At one point, I had looked it up because, as we'll talk about later, I was the lucky recipient of the crime prompt. And I wanted to make sure I was doing what I was supposed to do. And so I started researching a little bit and was very dispirited by how no one seemed to have any idea what we were even talking about.
I think there's so many different, just because crime is such a large field, and everybody who kind of has a stake in it wants to protect their stake and kind of at the expense of all others, it gets easy to kind of break off into little cliques and clubs. And can sometimes make it very hard to just get people together to agree on crime. Everyone's got to kind of throw a bit at something else, which you know can be quite damaging because it does get divisive. It does mean that you start to say, well, my kind of crime is the one that counts, and yours doesn't. I don't like that.
There are no limits to where we will be territorial as a species.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think maybe of all the genres we discuss, maybe science fiction has a lot of little clicks as well, I would say. But, you know, crime does seem to be just on the surface, you know, just in the fact that you can go into a bookstore and it might be racked as crime, or it might have a section called mystery or mysteries and thrillers. You know, it really runs the marketing, you know, sometimes runs very different on these things. And so it does seem to be very fragmented and that's interesting to know, you know, to think about the fact that, you know, writers themselves, as they're trying to keep their little territory, might slam other aspects of crime. So what we talked about at the top was, you know, crime is the overwhelming, that underlying fundamental piece that is gluing all of these different fractures together. You know, there's a crime in each of these. Mystery is maybe a different way of looking at it. You know, a noir piece is different. Let's talk a little bit about motives. I mean, it seems to me we talk about desires and we talk about consequences. So a big thing in crime fiction, and I know, Jay, you brought this up previously to us in a side conversation. Let's talk a little bit about motivation of characters.
Mm-hmm. I'm really curious to people who have written this, because I've read this a lot, but I haven't written it. And I wonder at what point you start thinking, like, do you start with the bad guy's motive? Is that what shapes the whole story? Do you need to come up with a motive in order to get this particular crime to happen, or what?
A good way to do it, I think. I mean, you're going to get a lot of people who will set out and think of the crime first, or set out and think, you know, what's my puzzle box going to be, and then arrange the characters around it, which is a trap. I've fallen into it when I've tried to write mystery. You can sometimes start out with the crime itself, and then you get lost because you've got no real attachment to what you're writing. I think that a good way to do it is to set out with your character, just figure out who they are, what they want. Once you know what they want, you can then figure out what's the quickest way to get that, and that will tell you what your crime is. And then from there, you've got your plot, because suddenly you've got a character who's got a desire and a limitation and a conflict, and everything comes from there. So I think if you set out and do that first, and then the plot will kind of happen around it, is a more organic way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. It's just so funny to me. I said this earlier, but every time I hear this, it brings me right back to sort of that creative writing 101, where it's like, well, yes, your character has something that they want. And, you know, I remember an editor specifically talking to me, and this is going to be more general than crime, but talking to me about, you know, characters will always get to their objective in the easiest method possible. You know, he said, like, you're not going to have someone try, if you put something on the other side of the street, the character's going to walk across the street to get it. You're not going to, they're not going to shoot a grappling hook to the, you know, to the, right. you know, tree across the street and shimmy across, not unless you electrify the street first, you know? So, mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, I mean, crime, when it comes down to that, it's you're going to look at, you know, what's the easiest way, what's this character going to do? And then after that, it becomes what's this character willing to do? And that's about knowing your character. I think was it Flannery O'Connor who said, and I may have used this before in a previous episode, but she talked about fiction as about writing as what people will do despite everything, what people will do, you know. And I think that the crime fiction is it's crystallized in that in crime fiction better than anything.
Mm-hmm. And there's an essay that Raymond Chandler wrote that's called The Simple Art of Murder, and there's. I've got a few issues with some of it, but on the whole, it's there's a lot of good stuff in it. There's a famous quote when he was talking about Dashiell Hammett, who wrote The Maltese Falcon, and he says that Hammett gave murder back to people who do it for a reason. And there's an element of that that is divisive. You know, he's kind of poking fun at one kind of crime fiction in order to praise Hammett, but mm-hmm. he gets at a central point that, you know, if you've got people in your story who want something, if there's a quick way for them to get it, if there's a motive for them to do it, then you've got your crime fiction. If you're doing it the other way and you're working backwards and you've got a crime and you're thinking, what's the craziest, zaniest way a person could have done this, then you're drifting away from a solid story, I think, from a character that's going to make sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, this may be a really good place for the exercise where you go through the newspaper and you look at, you know, news items that have happened in the last, you know, how much time is covered in a newspaper? How do newspapers work? You look up something that's happened and you construct a story around it. And you can kind of see, like, when you watch the TV procedurals, that they've got to have interns, you know, on Law and Order, whose job is to go through the headlines and list things that happened and, you know, 20 ways that this could be a motive for a murder. Mm-hmm. And then you have that idea, and then you have this exercise in constructing the obstacles. I liked that the comment about the grappling hook, you know, like the... But, you know, you have to put some obstacles in their way for them to have to get past.
Right.
But at the same time, you want the reason that they do it to be interesting, because if it's you're not going to have a story that's just the guy robbed a liquor store to get money to buy drugs, right? Unless there's some angle on that that makes, even though that's probably a fairly common motive for a crime, you don't want a crime that's just like every other crime unless you have some other reason that you're exploring it.
Absolutely. Should we move on to looking at Jim's, listening to Jim's story, and then we'll size it up and decide if it's a crime story?
That's all right. So anyway, that's the end of the show. You want to talk about a hiatus. I originally received this prompt in April. For those of you in 2013 listening to the archives, it is now September. I had written something back at the time, but since then I've completely thrown it out, and in the past week have written the thing that I'm about to read now based on something I saw in the news that captured my imagination. Having never shown my work before, I don't know if there's anything to do other than to just dive into it.
You dive into it.
Go for it.
Do you want a drum roll? We can set that up.
No, I will settle for nothing less than fanfare. This was something that I decided to call Cloudy with a Chance of Murder. Okay. I will just read it. Chip Chapman opened his bleary eyes at the sound of the maid's shrieks and, after several seconds too many, got around to realizing that he was wet. The splash as he bolted upright informed him that he was more than just wet, in fact. Until a second ago, Chip had been submerged up to his shoulders, sound asleep in the hot tub of the Marriott Courtyard Hotel. As his temples throbbed with hot agony and the maid continued trying to give him a heart attack, his eyes darted haphazardly around the courtyard and he struggled desperately to pinpoint the last thing he remembered. It had all started at the hotel bar. Chip and his cameraman, Bill, had met downstairs for a few badly needed drinks after trying to cover the Overland Park tornado for News Channel 7 and barely escaping with their lives. Going into meteorology, Chip had always seen himself spending his days staring at radar readings in a cushy office chair and spending his nights standing in front of a green screen, telling Kansas City whether it would be wise to bring a sweater to work. He'd never factored in those early years of his career, the years when he'd be the low man on the new local news totem pole. He had a master's degree in atmospheric physics, but until the chief weatherman got a better gig or retired, he would be the storm-chasing schlub whose job it was to take a camera out into the blizzard so people would know it was snowing outside. That night, this glamorous job had nearly gotten him impaled by a no-parking sign on live TV. This had rattled Bill a bit, and rattled Chip a whole hell of a lot. A few drinks quickly became quite a few drinks, which became telling the bartender to leave the bottle, which apparently became blacking out in a tepid hot tub. The chill of the air conditioning informed Chip that he was naked. His suit, tie, and telegenic yellow rain slicker were folded neatly on a lounge chair by the pool. At least he'd had that much sense. Chip looked down. The opaque water was the color of rust. Across from him in the water sat Bill, his tongue bulging from his bloated plum-colored face. Bill's shocked, bug-eyed expression was no doubt due in large part to the red studded dog collar buckled tightly around his windpipe. This was an awful lot to take in at once. Chip hurtled out of the water like it had been electrified. "Wait, wait, wait, hang on, it's okay, it's okay," he called after the poor middle-aged maid, who had promptly abandoned her cart and bolted down the corridor upon taking in Chip's nude, apparently blood-stained body. He meant for his words to be reassuring, but they came out more like frantic screams. He was starting to remember some kind of tussle after the bartender cut them off. Had they fought? Had they not fought? Had they actually started getting along very well indeed? And where the hell did Bill get a dog collar in the middle of a tornado? Was that just something he had on him at all times, just in case? One clear thought penetrated Chip's mental fog. Once the maid ran into someone or remembered she had a cell phone, his life would be coming to a spectacular end. His eyes dashed from Bill to the lounge chair and back again, and he made a snap decision. He had worked too hard to lose his freedom and reputation over something he didn't even remember doing. If he even did it at all. He was covered in cuts and bruises. For all he knew, that was his blood circulating through the jets. Chip decided not to think about that for the time being. He looked up. It was clear from the dark gray skylight that it was not yet dawn. Assuming Bill wasn't as heavy as he looked, there was still a chance to get him out of there before anyone else happened by and recognized them. He just hoped to God that the keys to the news van were still in Bill's pocket. Figuring out what had happened could wait until the Marriott was a distant in the rearview mirror. By midday, Chip would be back on Channel 7, only this time they would be filming him on the freeway from a helicopter.
Very nice, very nice.
That could be the start of something, I think.
I like that he was kind of using his detective skills to try to figure out what he had been doing.
I thought that's always a good start.
I like the assumption of guilt on his part.
He knows himself well enough.
Yeah, his first reaction isn't, you know, well, hey, maybe if I just wait here and the forensics turn up, then you know, right. I'll be fine. It's instantly, how do I get out of this?
right.
Exactly.
That's actually a really interesting twist on the wrongly accused, you know, because he may be wrongly accused, but he doesn't seem to be particularly persuaded by it.
That's actually pretty good. You could continue this piece where he just figures he's guilty, and then at the end and halfway through he realizes he's not, you know.
But by that point, he's committed so many other crimes.
Exactly.
That is sort of where my mind was going. Yeah,
I like that you've taken kind of the comedy, because there's a lot of really good funny.
There is, yes.
You know, crime, and I think we tend to talk, even a lot of really dark stuff has a really great kind of mordant sense of humor. But there are some, you know, hilarious, you know, films and books that are crime stories.
Absolutely.
And I have to say that. I had, for whatever reason, by pure happenstance, heard no fewer than three stories in the span of this past week in the news or in the media or on talk shows about people waking up with hangovers in hot tubs. and I thought there are too many of these coming onto my radar screen for me to ignore. So I started thinking about what that must be like.
So maybe like Caroline's I think earlier about constructing crimes out of the newspaper.
Exactly.
Maybe you've actually stumbled across a serial killer whose MO is that he puts people into hot tubs and falsely accuses them. There's actually one guy out there who's setting people up and putting them in hot tubs.
So you started with that idea, with the guy waking up in the hot tub.
Yes, that is where it all started.
What was your next step then?
Well, what I tried to do, I can't relate to waking up in a strange place. I'm not the blackout drunk type, but I tried. Basically, what I did was I took this bizarre situation and tried to put myself in the shoes of the person living through it. And you know, if you found yourself in these less than ideal circumstances and had to get out of it somehow, tried to kind of walk through the steps of what that might entail, with the assumption being that I would be spectacularly bad at it. and sort of took it from there.
So if you started with that moment, when did the, let's say he's a weatherman, right? Or he's a,
yes.
So yeah. How did that develop out of it? Was it just something you had to pick up a career, or was there like some reasoning behind it that made you think of it? Like, this guy would be perfectly bad at this.
One of the stories I had read about this waking up in the hot tub was an Arkansas broadcaster.
Okay.
Who had done it over the Labor Day weekend at one of his friends' houses, and then I started to think, you know, under what circumstances would this guy find himself in a strange hotel? And who would he be with, and what, you know, why would a weatherman need to travel? And, you know, it all started to spin out from there. And
it's almost as if there had been a lot of news coverage recently of people standing in front of storms.
something that has always been a pet peeve of mine, when they take the poor newscaster or, you know, professional journalist with some lofty degree in communications or media and you know, put them in a parka and make them stand on the freeway as the snow comes down so that they can report on the fact that the snow is coming down, as if I live in a city without windows.
It's interesting, you know, as I'm looking at this, you have Chip, and you actually put a little bit of, I guess I would say, a desire in there that maybe might lead to a criminal element, which is there's a line in there, and this is not, I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with Bill. It says, but until the chief weatherman got a better gig or retired, he would be the storm chasing schlub. So right there, to me, I'm like, okay, this has got something that's like a motive for something.
He is a striver. He understands that the local news is a cutthroat business,
right?
And that you can't be some sort of creepy pervert and end up being the chief meteorologist on News Channel 7. So it becomes all the more important to get out of there without being recognized, so that he one day have that dream job of pointing at clouds on a screen.
I mean, there's a lot of nice, just the way that you chose to characterize him in there, because you could write this character, you know, to be very sympathetic. And you're like, oh yeah, he's out there working hard every day, you know, trying to get ahead. And you clearly, you didn't take that path. I mean, there's just a lot of subtle kind of, and I think that's part of what, not that you can never like the protagonist in comedy, but I think that in this case is kind of what steers it toward comedy.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a little bit of disdain, authorial disdain, right?
Perhaps
altruism in crime fiction.
Yeah, right. It's always possible that Chip is on a path to redemption, and that he will find himself as he tries to keep everyone else from finding him. But
that's not the story you started.
What I like is that, I mean, that story, it kind of goes right back to the start of the episode, and that it could still be any kind of crime fiction. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a mystery element in it already, but there's also a noir element in it.
Mm-hmm.
From here, you know, that could be the end of a story, it could be in the middle of a story, it could be the start of a story, and it could be any kind of crime fiction.
Very true. So where do you go with it from here?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm trying to decide.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, National Novel Writing Month will be here before you know it.
Oh, November's just around the corner, that's right.
Sadly.
Well, the comment about it, what I was saying about the tone of the story, and that it could be any kind of story. I think I'm remembering this correctly, and if I'm telling this wrong, somebody can tell me. Richard Stark, who wrote the Parker books, that are sort of the very sort of lean noir kind of stories that with this very sort of violent antisocial protagonist, mm-hmm. was Donald Westlake, was his sort of name that he wrote under Moore, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think he started one of these books, and it ended up being funnier than he meant it to. It ended up not having the right tone to be a Parker book, but he had the plot already, and that was when he created Dortmunder, who's kind of his comedy character. But a lot of the plots really follow very similar sort of lines, because it's the guy who needs to figure out how to do this task, and he takes you very much through the different elements of how he makes the choices. But sort of depending on, you know, various elements in the story, they could lean sort of really dark and grim, or they can lean comedy. Mm-hmm. And he was able to write these two different kind of stories using the same skill set as far as plotting, but just a really different kind of characterization. And if you're interested in that kind of comedy heist story, the Dortmunder books are really good for that.
Yeah, absolutely they are.
I will take that under advisement. I just finished reading The Outfit a couple of weeks ago, and now I'm sitting here realizing that I'm more exposed to crime than I thought I was, because as I was starting this, I was racking my brain trying to think, have I even read that much crime? And now it turns out that I have. I just haven't been thinking about it that way.
You mean you read the comic or you read the book?
I read the book.
Okay, yeah, but they're very similar. And The Hot Rock is the first Dortmunder book, and that was made into a movie with Robert Redford, which I think is on DVD now. And it, you know, it follows fairly close, but it's a little bit of a kind of light, you know, sort of caper movie. But it's the same kind of idea, and there's a ton of them. And I think there was one that was actually published after he died that was about where they were hired to go after one of these guys who was one of the hedge fund guys who had made all this money, and all of his investors had basically a Madoff type character. So Westlake kind of went from, you know, writing Parker in the early 60s to writing about Bernie Madoff in the whatever decade this is called, which is kind of impressive. And you could sort of see how he was able to tweak those stories in a way that, you know, it still felt up to date.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But if you go back and read the first Stark novel, The Hunter, there's a few things in there that date it, such as how easily he fakes his ID. But aside from that, if you take those out, it could still be set right now. Mm-hmm. A lot of the elements of it, because it's good writing, because it's simple writing, are just as contemporary now as they did back then. Well, I assume as they did back then. I wasn't there.
Right.
I don't think anyone was reading it at the time thinking, you know, this right. will be a great novel in 40 years. But
So Caroline, you mentioned plotting, and I think that might be a good time to segue into just talking a little bit more, and we've already started this discussion, but starting a little bit more about talking more about writing crime and maybe some struggles that we've had, or things we've gone through or fears that we have. To me, crime fiction, it does seem a bit like plot is... Yeah. I think that's one thing that always made me nervous about writing a mystery or writing crime was that, you know, like, I have to have something very clever or people won't buy into it. You know, and I think, Jay, you kind of addressed this as being a pitfall that people can fall into. But that was actually something that kind of kept me away from trying it for a while, because I felt like if I couldn't put together a great heist, then what was the point? Do you guys, or Jay, or any of you, anybody who's written anything like this or just a fan, do you have any suggestions in terms of building that plot, even though I know we're saying start with that character, but are there things that stop you or that you struggle with in terms of like building out that plot to make it an exciting crime story?
I have very little confidence in my ability to surprise people with a mystery. That's the simple truth of it.
I mean, leaving mystery aside for certain, because I think that would be a separate answer. That's a very much, you know, a construct that you write in a different way, but I think just in terms of writing the crime itself, is to not worry about whether it's really, you know, the first time anyone's ever seen crime done, because most crime isn't new. Crime is some of, you know, is goes right back to when we first started hitting each other with rocks to get our food. So you just work on making it compelling. The oldest crime in the world can be compelling if you've written it the right way. So if you start to get nervous that you're writing something that's been done before, or that your crime isn't particularly original, take a few steps back and think, well, again, why are they doing it? What's unique about the situation rather than the crime? Why is my character doing this in a different way to the way the thousands of other characters would be doing it? And then reapproach it that way. And then you worry less about, is this the first time this particular crime has ever been committed? Because it won't be, unless you are creating something really outlandish. It's very difficult to come up with a brand new crime.
Caroline, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, I'm going to twist it a little different direction, which is that I haven't sat down to write, or I have sat down to write, but haven't gotten very far, actually a crime story or crime novel. But, and maybe it's something I should do, but I've always found that when I'm writing short fiction particularly, I absolutely use stuff that I learned as a mystery reader and as a crime reader all the time, because the story, and I think I've said this on an earlier show, my short stories that I write always end up pretty much being about one character who has a secret, and either about them hiding it or revealing it and how that comes about. And so just thinking through the through the deductive process of how is this character able to keep the secret? How are they able to, what is it that the other people do that set them off? What are the things? So I think thinking about the investigative process and just is a really good way to understand character, I think, and it is a way to build incidents onto each other, even if it's not in the particular service of solving a crime, which, when I say that, it makes me think I could probably write something about solving a crime. And actually, the issue that I would have with writing crime is different, but I might want to hold off on that if we're to finish talking about this one.
Okay, well, I think, and I may segue into that. I don't know what your issue is that you're going to talk about, but I have two things that I think about when I think of this. And one is, Jay just mentioned it. He said, well, let's, keep mystery as a separate question, because that's interesting to me. And constructing a mystery is very interesting. I've done it a few times, and actually my audio show, Wormwood, is not a crime show. Even though it does have some noirish elements at times, it's more of a horror show, but it's structured around a mystery. It's not structured around a murder, but like the entire first season is built around former psychiatrist is brought to this town because he had this weird vision, and he's like this occult guy now anyway, and this whole thing is what's going on in this town and what is behind, and there is a murder. Actually, I guess in a way it's kind of a crime story, because the whole thing is that he's had this murder of a drowned woman, but he gets to this town and the only drowned woman is from 70 years ago, but then while he's there the murder actually happens. And so he's actually, it was sort of a little play on that murder mystery, but him uncovering the plot behind it leads to a larger kind of mystery, a more of an occult based mystery. But that was really interesting. And I think that I have a lot of nervousness around building a mystery, but I've done it a couple times, once in a screenplay and then with this project. And I think that what helped me was being able to work with other writers and collaborate. I know that's an answer I go to a lot, but it really helps me. I was able to bounce things off. And in fact, I wrote a screenplay prior to doing the Wormwood project, which was, I thought it was kind of interesting. It was sort of a little riffing off Memento back when that was popular, but it was more like there was a young woman and she has multiple personality disorder. So you're following her and she's trying to figure out what's going on. And there's some, somebody died. And then, but at the same time, she's waking up in different places and she's lost time and she's got these other people inside of her that are taking over part of the time. And so I had a lot of fun with that one, writing with another co-writer where, we're like, okay, and this is happening, okay, but, and we were really talking about, like, this person, there was, how do I describe this? There was much more of a structural process to it, in that it was like, we were very conscious of, are people going to figure this out yet? And I want to say that we didn't even fully determine who the killer was until we had written at least, maybe 40 pages, but then we had to go back and make sure that it all worked. We weren't doing a cop-out thing where it's like nobody you ever knew. We actually made sure it was sort of built in, throughout, but it took us that much writing to kind of really solidify what was going on, you know, and who the killer was, and if it was one of the people inside of her or if it was somebody external, and what that all meant and how it would all play out. And so it was a really interesting experience, and I don't know that I have any advice for people listening to this. You know, that's what I'm struggling with, is I know kind of the experience I've had, but I'm not sure that I'm in some ways it's really hard for me to figure out, other than just a lot of talking about it, you know.
Right.
I mean, I think when you're constructing mysteries, a good thing to think about, a good place to write from, is people's assumptions, because that's really what we're dealing with when you're writing a mystery. A mystery itself isn't a living, breathing thing. That's just a fact of what's happened in the plot.
Mm-hmm.
What makes the mystery, what makes it stand up or fall down, is the decisions that people make as they're moving around this plot. And everyone's going to look at the same object or the same fact in a different way, so you can get quite a lot of mileage out of the fact that your characters are going to get things wrong. Your characters are going to make assumptions.
Yes.
They can look at something and make completely the wrong assumption, and that's where your mystery can come from. The first book I wrote ended up being a mystery book. It was a short story that ran long by about 60,000 words.
Wow.
And that it started with a very, very cliched idea of a guy waking up next to a dead body,
mm-hmm.
Much like Jim's. And it's those first few decisions he makes, those first few assumptions that he makes, that turn it into a mystery in a way, because he goes off in completely the wrong direction, does completely mm-hmm. the wrong things. And then it's not until right near at the end when he takes a step back and thinks, I've been looking at this completely wrong. The answer's obvious. But because he's run off down this whole avenue, he's done the hard work himself for the reader, because he's the one who's driven that. The minute he steps back and thinks, wait, what's the only actual logical answer? Then he figures it out.
Yeah.
And I think that's an honest way to treat the reader as well, because there's nothing wrong with the reader figuring it out in advance. If you've done your work correctly, it can be good for them to figure it out, and for them to be kind of sat there thinking, I wish this character would just wise up and figure this out. it's kind of an honest way of doing it.
That's a fantastic point. In fact, it's something I'm writing right now, which I'll talk about when we get to our Show Your Work section. It is, I didn't realize it, I didn't put it in these words until you just said that, but it is based on the protagonist making a huge wrong assumption almost right from the start. And it's based completely in his character and his past, something that happened to him before, and so he assumes that that's what's happening again, and that's the true, that's sort of the big red herring of the story. And I'm ruining it for everybody who's eventually going to read it. But I mean, there's a twist to it where it's not that assumption is completely wrong, you know, and he doesn't have it right. And that was something that really worked for me, because it actually worked to the character as well, because it showed me that the protagonist was kind of arrogant, and he was kind of really self-centered in that he just assumed that this was going again, and that's where we wanted him to be. We wanted this protagonist to be like that. He carries a lot of that with him. And so, you know, it made perfect sense for what had happened to him in the past to believe that this was going on again, and, you know, then and for that twist to really throw him, it worked well. It's gonna make for a good reveal in the piece that I'm working on.
Both of you are talking about characters making mistakes, mm-hmm. and I think that that's a really good thing to think about in this genre, because if somebody's not screwing something up, either the story will be over very quickly, or it will never end, because the guy's not going to get caught, right?
Right.
I think just like starting to think about what kind of blind spots can people have, what kind of bad assumptions. What a lot of mystery plots I've noticed, what they fall apart in is there's a lie, and it's either a harmless lie or it, you know, it seems like it's a harmless lie. It seems like it's a mistake. Like maybe they lied about the time that the crime occurred, because for some reason that's totally unrelated to the crime, something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's so you really look at what you know, like look at what kind of false assumptions and what kind of false conclusions can be drawn, what kind of lies people can tell, and there's so much to play with in that.
And a lot of what can be interesting about this is the way that despite the best laid plans of the heist or the murder or whatever it is, the way that the people involved start to turn on each other, or the personalities involved end up being the undoing, as opposed to the police or something else. I'm thinking partially about The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, but I'm also thinking about the book and later the movie Quick Change, which it was a Bill Murray movie. The book was written by a guy named Jay Cronley. Basically, they commit the perfect bank robbery, completely get away with it, but then are waylaid by the fact that they commit the perfect crime, but then they fail at getting out of town, basically, because New York is too much of a hellhole to let them go, and so they end up, you know, their getaway car gets stolen, and you know, they get robbed, and you know, every possible thing that can go wrong goes wrong. Jay Cronley had another book, I can't remember what it was called, but basically the three criminal protagonists get away with their crime by kidnapping the entire police department at the shift change, and so that there's no one to stop them, but their own sort of foibles and personality conflicts end up derailing the entire thing.
And that's such a huge part of noir fiction, not talking just about mysteries, but I mean, how many times is it the guy shouldn't be going with that woman, but he just can't help himself?
Right.
I mean, it's all about the imperfections of our characters and their desires, and you know, how they'll follow them even if they know in every fiber of their being that it's wrong, you know?
And totally, one thing I thought about is if you hear a character, or if you have a character say at some point, oh, as long as this goes okay, then it'll be fine. Even if that's not part of the plan, that's something to put a little, oh, that's something I can use, because as long as that goes okay, it'll be fine. If something happens to screw it up, then suddenly you've got a whole other set of complications to work with.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a great piece, and I guess I would call it crime fiction, but it really stands out to me as something I've seen in the last few years that is a crime piece where it's not the character who's doing anything bad. They're trying to do the right thing, but they're not the detective or anything like that. Have any of you seen the film Red Belt by David Mamet?
Yes.
This is a film I really loved, this movie, and this is about basically a jiu-jitsu instructor who's you know, just barely scraping by, and he's got his little dojo and he's training people, but it's losing money. And basically what happens is, you know, one little bad thing happens. It's just driven by, you know, a woman who's had a bad time, and a cop who makes one very small mistake. These are innocent kind of mistakes. You know, they're just very human things. And then the guy tries to do the right thing, but he maybe just goes to the wrong person for help. He does one little wrong thing, but then it's a series of almost jiu-jitsu-like moves. The plot sort of is about this guy sort of kind of moving and slipping out of the plot just as it gets him in its vice, and then, you know, and then it twists on him again, and then it twists on him again, and he's constantly like sort of reacting to it. And the film plays out, I think, beautifully, but I like it because it's not a typical character you would associate with as a crime protagonist, but it's actually a guy trying to be like the last honorable man in town. It's almost more of the samurai flick in that way, you know?
Right.
I just looked this up, and I know that you're talking about writing. You did not mention that this guy is Chiwetel Ejiofor, who is the operative from Serenity, which means I want to see this now.
Yes, awesome. I'm sorry. He
okay,
is, and he's great.
Okay. Carry no, that, on.
As a film,
I go to my Netflix queue.
As a film that's very meticulous in its plot, and I really like it because I see the plot as sort of a metaphor for jiu-jitsu, and the way you're always sort of redirecting something, you know, you're kind of taking your opponent's motion and redirecting it. It's him trying to do that throughout the plot, and it unfolds and it tightens on him, and then he gets released for a moment, but then it folds on him again. It's very fascinating, and I highly recommend
this movie. Go ahead.
No, that was it. That was it. I just wanted to recommend it while we're talking about that stuff.
I was just going to say, while we're talking still about, you know, constructing the plots, as the plot and character go hand in hand, I mean, they feed off each other. So as much as at the start I'm saying... sorry, I broke my microphone then.
Oh, dear.
As much as at the start I'm saying you've got to focus on the character and then you'll find the plot. Once you're into that, you'll find that it then starts to feed backwards, so the plot will inform your character. When I was writing that mystery story, or what turned into the mystery story, when he wakes up next to the dead body, I knew as a crime story he's got to do the wrong thing here. But I wasn't really, didn't really have a grip on the character at the time. So I'm thinking, well, why would he do the wrong thing? And just how could he get it so badly wrong that he's going to drive a story? Because I'm sure if we all woke up for some reason next to a strange dead person, I'm not sure we'd instantly leap to the lengths that people do in some of these crime stories. So I thought, I've got to find an actual reason why he doesn't just panic or freeze or call the cops or pass out. And then I thought, well, why would somebody run from the cops? Well, what if he's got some kind of, what if he's an ethnic minority and he knows, you know, that he's going to get the blame for this no matter what? Mm-hmm. So that suddenly feeds your story in a different way, because suddenly you've got a whole different character. You've got a whole different set of motivations. And that's going to then play out again through the rest of the story, because it's going to impact every single decision he makes.
Absolutely.
So yeah. It can work both ways.
Yeah. In that case, you know, it's starting with that situation like you talked about, or Jim's story in the hot tub, but everyone's going to react to it differently. What you, how you define that character tells you, and you can start with something as simple as, well, he's got to make the wrong decision here, but that is like, there's as many reasons you could make that wrong decision. You just mentioned ethnic minority. It could be somebody that's got a record. It could be a million different things, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's where your story becomes individual and personal, you know?
And that's also where it gets back into the idea of being social fiction. You know, once you're talking about the issues of ethnicity and race relations and things like that, you're opening up whole new vistas of discussion or exploration.
Yeah,
very,
I mean,
true.
That's where my tastes will lead, because that's the kind of that's the aspect of crime fiction that I lean to most, is the mm-hmm. social aspect. So, as much as all of our characters are going to have different ways of responding to things, as writers, we're all going to look at the same situation and bring a different set of rules to it.
I feel like there's a writing prompt waiting for us where we all take Jim's story and we have someone wake up in a hot tub with a dead body, and then we just do what we will do with it from there, and what we choose will, you know, we'll see how many different variations on the hot tub murder that we get.
I sanction this behavior.
I want to answer one quick question from Twitter. Mizelle on Twitter, Julia, I believe her name is. She just quickly asked if we had tips on plotting, and then mentioned index cards or flowcharts. So, you know, we've been talking about plotting, but is there anything a little more structural that we want to talk about in terms of how do you guys work? How do you work with plot? Do you do a lot of outlines? Do you keep track on flowcharts, or are you more just right by the seat of your pants type of people? We talked about pantsers versus plotters at one point
right.
in the show. So how about you guys? Jay, as our guest, how do you handle this?
I mean, the pantsers versus plotters thing, I remember you referenced Chuck Wendig.
Yes, absolutely.
Who's a friend of mine, and we disagree on this a bit. but I'm completely seat of the pants for the first draft. Find your character and then follow your character, mm-hmm. see where it goes. And then when you come to second, third, and fourth drafts, that's when you then break out and start applying what you know in terms of structure and themes and making sure that, you know, that they all serve each other. But first draft, no index cards, no nothing, just mm-hmm. something happens, and then something else happens, and then it just keeps happening.
I think I'm kind of like that too. I mean, I do, when I talked about that screenplay and stuff before, we had to kind of write back and forth. This is with my writing partner, where we actually write back and forth to each other, so kind of surprising each other, but that's us finding the characters. And then in this case, it was about halfway through, not a complete draft, but about halfway through, that we started, you know, figuring out what it was we were telling. And then, you know, even then we were kind of going back and making sure it all worked from the beginning. But I can see that absolutely, of an entire first draft, or even just, you know, half of a draft to just kind of find your character. You know, I, to me, that's very important. I need to do that because I don't know. Sometimes I need to just write with one foot in front of the other, you know, so to speak. That's a terrible metaphor, analogy, whatever. But you guys know what I'm saying. I did that with that Smitty story. You know, I didn't know what it was about. I just knew the first line, and I had to go from there, you know. If I were to expand that into something, I would probably have to stop, sit back. And for me, I do a lot of sort of outlining. I've never really done index cards a bit. I just sort of make lists. Like, if this happens and then that happens, and I really just think about that, and try to put that back into, you know, just maintain that outline and put it back into the draft in some way.
I've never done.
Go ahead, Jim. You go.
Oh.
Sorry.
We need to be able to see one another. I've never done index cards. I have tried both outlining and listing and sort of flying by the seat of my pants, but I find that when I outline, I tend to end up twisting the characters to cram them into the plot. You know, and that always ends up seeming backwards to me. I'd rather like we've said before, sort of try and discover who this person is and then sort of let them do what they would do.
Yeah.
I have become, I think, fairly recently more of a plotter, like in the last couple of years, than I used to be. And I've been writing long, I'm still mostly in short form, but I've been writing longer things. And I'm usually more of making lists, and I'm kind of, but I develop my beginning fairly well. Like, this is the starting point. This is what I need to happen. And then, I mean, honestly, the last thing I did, I wrote an email to a couple of the people from Fantastic Fangirls that I blog with. I wrote one to Sigrid and I wrote one to Jen. And I'm like, this is what I need to do something with this story. What do you think? And they both came out to me, basically, I'm like, I started the story, tell me what I started. And they both came back with really interesting suggestions. Neither one of them was exactly what I wanted. You know, it was exactly where I saw it going. But they kind of gave me enough tools, and I was like, okay, you know, based on what you think this is doing and what you think this is doing, I can sort of see how that converges. So I ended up coming up with a different plot than either of them suggested. But that was kind of the collaborative process that they was talking about.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like you're landing a little bit on the way I work.
to sort of realize, it's more like seeing what story I've started to tell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that applies across all kinds of writing, but the things that I've done that have more of a, like I said, I do more of the mystery than the actual crime side of it, I think tend to work that way. And I usually don't know exactly the ending. Like, I don't know what I need the plot solution to be, but I know where I need the character to get. And so then I have to figure out what the plot needs to be to get the character to that place.
Right, right.
I think it's healthy not to know everything about the ending, because, I mean, so many times you'll be writing a story, particularly the longer the story gets and the more kind of investment you've put in along the way into this character. As you're getting towards the end, if you've got a firm, set idea of how the story has to end, you're going to find that the character doesn't want to go there, or doesn't want to go completely there. And you then get kind of caught in a tug of war between, are you going to follow your character or are you going to follow your plot? And I mean, the character has to win, but it can be a trap that you can fall into of, well, you know, how am I going to make him into Darth Vader?
Right.
So you've got to be willing to follow the character there.
It's interesting, but I definitely am a person who have written a lot where I keep the middle very open, and I have a beginning and an end. But you're absolutely right. There are times where I think having an end in mind often helps me plot, in a sense, like, because I just have in the back of my mind, well, I know I want to end up there. So what are the obstacles I can throw that will eventually end, you know, lead him there? But it's a very good point that it doesn't always go that direction. And I think there have been times where I've scrapped whatever ending I had in mind and gone a different direction. I think you have to be able to do that. You know, if you're going to do that, it's great to have the ending in mind, but listen to your characters as you're writing with them. And, you know, if it goes in a different direction, let it go. See, I mean, the worst you can do is write for a bit and then realize that that doesn't work either. And, you know, you've got to scrap it and go back to something else, you know?
And sometimes you can catch yourself by surprise. You get to the ending and you're not expecting to. I know when I was writing that book that by the time I was halfway through and I'd kind of admitted that it was going to be a book, I thought, well, I know where this is going to go. I've got a really cool final scene. So you then start to write towards that scene. But then you reach a point when something happens and a character says a particular line, and I just think, wow, that would be a really heartbreaking moment to end the story. Mm-hmm. But I've still got to get to this final scene. I've got to put that in. And then you step back and think, well, no, I'll just end it on the natural end point. And that final scene, I can use that in some other story some other day.
Yeah. It can be hard to let that go sometimes, that scene, that end goal you had in mind. But it's great that you could step back and see that. Do you think, did that happen for you on the first draft? Or did it happen not until a second draft, or where you realized that, oh, this is where it needs to end here?
I recognized it on the first draft, but I fought it and I kept going.
Okay.
And then the writing ground to a halt because I just could not get to where I wanted to go. Mm. And then I just went back and thought, well, there's a reason for that because the story's finished. By the second draft, the ending was locked in. It was just the rest of the book that sucked.
Were you still able to save that ending to use in something else?
Yeah, I've still got it.
He's waiting for the right piece. I have one last sort of technical question for you guys. I don't know if anybody has feelings on it, but one of the other struggles I personally had when thinking about crime fiction early on was the idea of research. That there seems to be, and we've talked about this a bit before in previous shows in different aspects, but with crime it always seemed daunting to me because a lot of shows are sort of police procedurals or books or movies or police procedurals, and it felt to me like if I was going to sit down and write a crime story, I needed to know about guns or I needed to know about how the police force worked or the basic hierarchy, right. Even, you know, things that I just don't know, but I see them on TV shows and I'm like, yes, I want the cops are going to come to this scene. I don't really know what they would do here because right. I've ballistics not been at the scene DNA of a murder testing. Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I remember sidestepping this in one sci-fi, by going sci-fi with it, and I had detectives who were, you know, trying to, you know, you just threw gobbledygook at it, and it worked fine because it was, mm-hmm. you know, a sci-fi thing. Has anybody run into that? Has anybody overcome those fears or dealt with that or know anyone who has done that or have good resources?
Well, it turns out actually, I just default to the criminals.
Yeah, I mean, that's the natural thing, right? I mean, that's definitely what I have done as well.
That actually segues to what I alluded to earlier, is sort of a, I guess, dovetails with the same concern you're talking about, which is I worry about authenticity
right.
with crime, not in the like technical precision, because my kind of feeling is if I wanted to do that kind of research, I could probably find the resources for it. It's more like what Jay is saying about, you know, this being social fiction. And so, you know, to what extent... You know, I mean, you know, I'm not from the streets, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, to what extent, you know, what do you have to do to get into that experience? You know what I'm saying? And mm-hmm. you don't just want to be there as a tourist, right? You don't want to say, okay, well, because I'm going to write a great crime novel, I'm going to suddenly be interested in the experience of people in a particular area or a particular. I think it has to be part of something that you're already interested in. And mm-hmm. so I think you have to find a way to approach that. So I guess that's sort of the other side of this, I think, the same concern that Dave has.
Yeah. I mean realism in fiction is always a con because mm-hmm. you're writing mm-hmm. fiction.
Oh, sure.
But obviously the trick is that we've got to get a feeling of realism. It's a con that you're playing through writing. You've got to get just enough detail in there that it seems real. And then as long as it seems real, you can do whatever you want. I know the book Clockers by Richard Price, which mm-hmm. was one of the big inspirations behind The Wire. He did a lot of research for that. He spent a lot of time with police. He spent mm-hmm. a lot of time on the other side with the gangs. But then he went out and created a fictional city in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And even the phrase Clockers, I mean, people thought, well, it's because these kids are on the streets, you know, 24/7 selling the drugs. So they were called clockers because they were around the clock.
Did he just make that up?
He made that up completely. But mm-hmm. then within months of the book coming out, kids and police were using the phrase mm-hmm. because it felt real. So mm-hmm. all you've got to do is get enough detail in it to make it seem real. And then you can run crazy with your fiction. Right. I remember a previous episode for your show with when Paul read out his story about Pinocchio in the whale. And there was the entire story is impossible. Nothing mm-hmm. in that story could actually happen. But because he'd thrown in a few little phrases here and there, he'd done a bit of research into what is inside a whale and then sprinkled it through the story, the whole thing hangs together, even mm-hmm. though the whole thing is impossible.
Right, right. I think that's always what I strive for. It's just that, you know, it's one of those things that I guess in some ways I sidestep things, and when I was writing Wormwood, you know, we kind of made it a small town, so I only had to deal with a sheriff and sort of, you know, and I don't even think that the sheriff's department really operates, the way it really does in that county that I'm basing it on. But I tried to do just a little bit of research here and there to try and get enough in, but it wasn't really the point of the story, and so I don't think anyone really minded it. But there are times where I'm kind of like, yeah, I want to write that cool thing where the cops show up on the scene, but I have no idea what they do once they get there, you know. Right. And aside from doing ride-alongs or whatever, you know, you do, and the research, you know, I get, you know, that Richard Price did a lot of research and did a lot of that stuff, but, and I think it's like that, you know, he did enough to know maybe what he could break, what rules he could break, what he could make up, you know, and yeah, I think your point well taken that, you just need enough to kind of, that it is a con in the end, and you have to make it just believable enough. It's just, I think that comes back to a confidence in writing, you know, and I think the more you know about this stuff, the easier it is to have the confidence to know when you've got enough there. And that, I think that's just a little scary for some of us, you know. I remember going to the bookstore and buying like books on ballistics and stuff just because I wanted to feel like I knew something, you know,
right.
I wouldn't even know some of the parts of a gun, you know what I mean? And I didn't want it, like the cop to be going like, yes, when I pull the little handle thingy, you know. So you have to have that
you
basis.
Don't want it to sound like an 8-year-old playing cops and robbers in the in the street.
There's two other aspects to it as well. I mean, the first is that research in a way can be a trap. I mean, if you get shot, once the bullet enters your body, if you do your research, all bets are off. The bullet can go anywhere. It can bounce around. It can ricochet. It can vanish. It can do all kinds of crazy things. But then if you start putting that into your story, the reader might be thrown out because they'll think, well, I know where the bullet went in, and it's a bullet, so it's got to come out somewhere, or it's going to come out the opposite of where it came in. So even by being completely realistic and saying someone might get shot in the leg, but it might come out through their other leg or something, then you actually throw your reader a little bit because they'll think, well, that doesn't make sense from what I've seen.
So you have to play to their expectations a little bit. Yeah, even though there will be someone who will, you know, like I think back to Jim and his the what was it? Was it Top Gun, Jim?
I had a roommate in college whose dad was a fighter pilot in Vietnam, and it was impossible to watch Top Gun with him because he his battle cry was those turkeys,
right? So you have the two flip sides. There's always going to be somebody who can, you know, take apart the little bit of authenticity, but then you have a basic reader expectation. You know, that, as you say, Jay, people could get thrown off if you actually, you know, get, in a way, get too real, which is interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way.
I mean, go on.
And I was just going to say, I guess the other thing is we don't need to limit ourselves, I guess, to saying, okay, if I'm going to write crime fiction, it has to be like The Wire, because, I mean, The Wire kind of did The Wire, and we don't need a million people to write that same story.
Right.
But I'm like, you know, crime happens everywhere, so there's, and I think of something like, and I haven't read these yet, but the Daniel Woodrell, who wrote Winter's Bone, which I know he does a very noir kind of sensibility, but in a rural setting, and in sort which is something like, I'm not really from that area, but I could probably write something like that in a way that I couldn't necessarily write an episode of The Wire, and I'd be okay with that.
Yeah, Woodrell's. I read Tomato Red, and we talked about it briefly on the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast, and you know, that was a great book, and it was. I'd call it crime fiction, but it was a real literary kind of crime fiction where it wasn't necessarily like a clear plot, like heist plot or con plot that unfolds. There is murder, but it ends in a looser way, and it is definitely something where I think what he did is he kind of really got into his main character, and there's a great part towards the beginning where he is sort of like, you know, he's a drug addict, he's an ex-con, but he's sort of like, he wants to break into these rich people's houses, and he realizes as he gets in there that he doesn't know how to describe anything. He doesn't have the vocabulary to describe the objects he sees, and he sort of says that. And there's a real honesty in that, you know, that's kind of thing that I think you could get into without, you know, being that person, you know, kind of putting yourself in that mindset and figuring that out. So, you know, there's a lot that happens in there, and there is a murder in there, there's death and stuff like that, but it's sort of played in a setting where you don't really need to get fully into what the cops are doing. They're just not really important in that story in that way, you know, so it works.
The other thing I wanted to say about research, because I said there's two aspects to it, the other side of it, the good thing is that research can give you a story.
Absolutely.
I decided I was going to set out and I was going to write a very big epic crime novel that was going to have 3 or 4 different points of view. And I said, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to research this in advance. And one of the things I did was I got in touch with a police officer from back home, from where my stories are set down in England, and started talking to him about it. And I said, I want to write from a cop's point of view, but I want to get it right. I want to actually find this person as a character. What don't you like about crime fiction? What don't you ever see represented?
Uh-huh.
And based on his answers of what he wants to see, you've suddenly got a whole story that you would probably never thought of a whole character. So it can work both ways. Research can trap you, but it can also create a whole new story for you.
That's great. So call your local police officer.
I mean, I would say to people, don't be scared to go into cops, because often they are willing to do it. I know Ian Rankin, the Scottish crime writer, when he first started, he went into a police station and asked if he could sit and talk to someone about police procedural stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they were willing to do it. He had to put his name on a register so that if crimes were committed that sounded like what he'd been asking, then they knew to come to.
That's great. Man. That's a great story.
You know, they were totally willing to sit down and go, yeah, ask you questions and we'll give you stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was better to do it off the record because you'll get juicier stuff, but you can do it on the record.
Right.
Isn't he the one who auctioned off like a tour of whatever city he writes about, and J.K. Rowling is the person who bought it?
Yes.
So that's what she wants to see. You know, she doesn't care about Hogwarts. She wants to see where Ian Rankin writes his crime stories. So.
Yeah, they both live in Edinburgh, but obviously they write completely different fiction, which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, does anybody else have anything they want to talk about in terms of writing crime fiction? I think, you know, we've definitely covered a lot here, and I think it's covered a lot of the questions and struggles I've faced. So does anybody else have anything?
I think we're good.
All right. So let's talk about what we're working on. So let's start with our guest, Jay. Anything that you want to plug or anything you want to talk about that you're working on right now?
I'm halfway through a rewrite on a book that's not crime at all. It's like a pulpy action adventure thing set in the 40s.
Nice.
So hopefully I might actually be able to announce something about that soon on Do Some Damage, because we might be looking at just getting it out as an ebook. I don't know yet. We'll wait and see.
Nice.
I would like to get in a quick plug if I can for a collection that Do Some Damage did. I've got a story in it, but there's 7 other writers who've all got, like, they've all done fantastic stuff. So if anybody wanted to type in Collateral Damage into their ebook Kindle store, or however you magically do it these days, you'd find a nice cheap collection there that's got me in it, but it's actually got 7 other good writers as well. You'll be able to see completely different takes on crime fiction. Each person in it has got a completely different take on how to construct a crime story. So it'd be a good kind of way to see how you can look at the same theme and come up with 7 or 8 completely different stories.
And I think you've got that for a completely ridiculous price on Amazon, if I'm not mistaken. It's a really good price.
I think it was like $9.99 when I looked.
Yeah. And so definitely. And you can also catch Jay on the Do Some Damage podcast. And is it dosomedamage.com? Is that the site as well?
Yeah, dosomedamage.com. Yeah. It's a collective, so there's... how many of us are there? There's 8 of us, and we 7 different days, and then 2 people alternate the Monday. But every day you'll get a different writer. There's some published writers on there, some unpublished writers, and me kind of in the middle of the week shouting my mouth off. But again, you get you know 8 completely different takes on the world.
Nice. All right, Caroline, what are you working on?
I'm sort of in between. I just finished the story that I was talking about. I've got a couple things that I've started. I think I'm going to write something long over the next few months. And I'm trying to... I was at Dragon Con this past weekend. It went to several... Even though people think of that as just being sort of a costuming and general mayhem and stalking Will Wheaton or whatever gets done there, which is all things we did. But not me personally. But they're actually, there's a really pretty great writing track. And so I went to some of the sci-fi writer panels particularly. And so they talked about short fiction, and they taught several of the writers there had websites or sort of resources about short fiction that I've been meaning to look at. And so I'm kind of in between for November for Nano, whether I want to try to do another big project or to try to get maybe a couple stories done during that month, really started and ended. So I have a lot of ambition. We'll see how that goes. I had a lot of ambition this summer too.
All right. Sounds good. Jim, how about you?
Well, in addition to the weekly opinion column that I'm continuing to write over at ifanboy.com, I've been trying to decide recently whether I wanted to expand the crime prompt that I just read into something more substantial, or whether I want to try something a little less blood-soaked. I've spent a lot of time working on stuff like this, and I'm trying to figure out what I can do for me. Mm-hmm. Just for my own amusement right now. And I was surprised by how much I ended up doing that most recent story for my own amusement. So maybe I'll see where that goes.
Well, did this discussion push you any way, any direction?
It did, actually. It forced me to think a little bit more about whether I would need to outline what happens to this poor guy or not.
Right. All right, excellent. For me, one of the things as we went on to our unintended hiatus was that I was putting together. We had put together with an artist. I had talked about this previously. A comic book miniseries, and the artist had drawn 11 pages, and we put this together. This is a spinoff of our show Wormwood, and so. We brought that and another sci-fi script that we had done 8 pages of and put that into a nice comic book format. I did all the lettering. We packaged it, and we actually, created a little 8-page comic book and another 11-page comic book. So we brought these down to San Diego Comic-Con, and we actually found a publisher. So So that was one of the big things that happened to me during our hiatus, and one of the reasons that I just got really busy is that we have a publisher, and I have a publishing contract actually in front of me that we had to make some changes on and send back, all those little details that you have to do. But we're actually very excited about it, and the publisher has I believe put us on the schedule. So at this point, and this is tentative, so I mean, this may change, and I will keep you guys up to date as things go along. But I believe as early as February of next year, we may be solicited in the previews. That's the comic book distributor Diamond. It's their big guide that all the retailers order from. So I'm going to need to call on our fan base.
I'll see.
Pre-order that comic book when it hits the previews guide. So I'm very excited about that. So I'm in the midst of scripting that. That's the big thing in front of me right now. So that was kind of big, and hopefully you will all forgive us for our hiatus, because we did get some good stuff out of it. The other thing I've got going on right now, I'm still doing the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast with Paul, and we're covering the DC Comics 52 relaunch, which I know Jay just wrote about as well. We're every week this month, we are sitting down with all the books, or almost all the books. Paul's going to read them all, and we're discussing them, what we think of the number one issues. Paul is also doing reviews on ifanboy.com for each of them. So I hope people tune in and check that out, because that's a lot of fun. It's all new beginnings, or relaunched number one titles, and it's kind of fun for us to. I've always talked about the beginnings of stories being very exciting to me. Opening up that new book and the excitement of what could possibly happen here before being horribly disappointed a lot of the time. but these number ones are really, it's like Christmas, and I'm having a lot of fun. So you can check that out at the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast. And I think that's it for us. Next time, we're coming back again. We're going to keep a regular schedule, tried our best to. And if we have another hiatus, hopefully we'll announce somebody being published again. That will be
right.
Nice. but I think the next one, Caroline, do you want to tell us about what we're doing next time?
We are planning to do one on historical fiction. I don't think we have a anybody has written for us yet. So if anybody wants to write about a meeting in a bar involving historical fiction and send it to us, we could probably use that on the show, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, originally Paul was going to write a Western for this. Just to let you guys know, Paul has kind of temporarily, at least for now, stepped down from this podcast because of his duties at iFanboy and Fuzzy Typewriter and every
he's
other...
He's very busy.
He's trying to limit himself to 11 podcasts.
Right. Exactly. So he is going to step away for a bit from ours, we're sad about that, of course, but we will carry on, and I'm sure he'll be a very special guest again soon. But yeah, for now, he's going to be. You can still find him on Fuzzy Typewriter and iFanboy as usual. And he was going to write a Western, but yeah, we now need somebody to do a Western or other type of historical fiction, for this next show.
There could be pirates.
Pirates and ninjas. All right. Well, Jay, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on and let me waffle.
Yeah, absolutely. Jay joined us at a ridiculous hour for him, and we really appreciate it. So we're going to let him get some sleep. Let's run through our list and everybody say goodbye in order without bumping heads this time, right? So I'm Dave.
I'm Jim.
Caroline.
Jay. And thank you all for listening.
I wasn't sure what our order was.
I know, I didn't really set you up with that. I just figured it'd be funnier if I said that and then everyone bumped heads again.
Oh, I get it.
I fully expected it to happen, but you guys pulled it off. I'm so proud. Anyway, that's the show, folks. We'll see y'all next time. Bye-bye. Hey folks, Dave Acampo just jumping right back in here because we are a little rusty at this and I forgot to give you the information on where you can contact us. If you would like to email us about the show with show suggestions, reviews, ideas, writing samples, anything you'd like, please email us at contact@thedeceptionist.org. Thedeceptionist.org is our website, and you can give us feedback on individual shows there. We also occasionally add additional content, additional writing, various things that we put on there, so be sure you check us out at thedeceptionist.org. If you want to seek us out on social media, we are there. We are on Twitter @deceptionists. There's no the, it's just @deceptionists. The would have been too long. You can also find us on Facebook. If you search Deceptionist on Facebook, you can find us and like us, and we like you doing that, so please do. And lastly, I'd just like to mention that if you like what we're doing and you're enjoying the show, please give us a review on iTunes. Write us up a nice little review, because that helps us, and we like to see how we're doing with you folks. So, thanks again for staying with us through our hiatus, unless we're coming to you from 2013, in which case, wasn't that a great show last week and this week? I think that's it, folks. Thank you very much. Sorry for the choppy audio this time around. We'll try and clean that up for next time. But hopefully you enjoyed the content of our crime episode. Thanks a lot, and have a good one. We'll see y'all next time.